This is the Yes to Life show, focusing on integrative medicine for cancer. Today, my guest is well-known American author, speaker, and practitioner Chris Kresser in London for a two-day speaking event. I was delighted to be able to catch him between engagements for the show. Hi Chris, really appreciate you taking time out of your UK tour to have a talk to us for the Yes to Life show.
Pleasure to do it, Robin.
So, I think there's a lot we could talk about today. Mm-hmm. Eating good food to keep you healthy and give you the energy you need for life sounds straightforward enough, but you only need to look at the sheer volume of new material on the subject that spews out every week and the state of public health to realise that it just ain't that simple. Why not?
That's a really good question. There's certainly a lot of confusion, and anyone who's paid any attention to this subject for any length of time will know that. You know, back in the 80s and 90s, it was all about low fat. And it was all about low carb, and now more recently the discussion about ketogenic diets and paleolithic type of diets. I think the important thing to do to resolve these kinds of conflicts is to look back at what a natural human diet was, because what evolutionary biologists all know is that all organisms are adapted to survive and thrive in a particular environment. And when that environment changes faster than our genes can adapt, that's when we start to have problems. And this is true not only for human beings, but for all other animals in nature. So for example, a couple decades ago, zookeepers started to notice that animals were getting sick in captivity, and they wondered why. And somebody got the bright idea that maybe it was because of the weird foods that they were feeding these animals in the zoo, and maybe they should go back to feeding them what they would normally eat in their natural environment. And guess what? Once they did that, the animals became healthy again. So we're not that different than these zoo animals in a way. We're eating foods in our modern zoo, if you will, that are far outside of the norm from evolutionary history. You know, we didn't typically eat foods that come in a bag and a box. We didn't eat, you know, primarily processed and refined flour and sugar, alcohol, and things that form the primary basis of our diet now. So we need to get back to what's natural for human beings.
It makes complete sense. I often look at people's pets and the food that they give them, and of course they're starting to, you know, they're all getting cancer and heaven knows what the pets are.
Absolutely.
And
And I would argue there's more awareness of what we could call a species appropriate diet in the veterinary community than there is in human beings.
Yeah. Okay, so I refer to our great country here as backward Britain on account of the enormous embedded resistance to change that persists in the realms of our healthcare. 15 years ago, I would have put the US, I would have ranked them well ahead when it came to leading us in exactly the wrong direction with healthcare. Now it's a different story. There's functional medicine and integrative medicine are really starting to have some impact in America. Over here, most people don't even know what functional medicine is. Many Americans want to tell me how bad things really are over there, but I tell them that's just because they haven't spent enough time in England, all right? They can't appreciate how far they've come, actually. So this weekend you've been working with a man who seems to have finally made a crack in the masonry of UK healthcare, Dr. Rangan Chatterjee, and he's doing it on a basis of functional medicine himself. That's where he's coming from. So, as I said, most people in the UK, they've never heard of it. Do you want to summarise the background and principles of functional medicine?
Sure. So functional medicine is fundamentally different than conventional medicine in several ways. I would call conventional medicine disease management rather than healthcare because the primary focus is to suppress the symptoms of disease rather than to address the underlying cause. So for example, if you go to the doctor and you have high blood pressure, what's going to happen? You're going to get a drug prescribed to lower your blood pressure. Yeah. Same thing with high cholesterol and many other problems, and there's rarely any investigation into what the underlying cause of the problem is in the first place. Whereas in functional medicine, we'll say, why is the blood pressure high? And, you know, is it diet? Is it lack of exercise? Is it lack of sleep? Is it too much stress? And we'll address all of those issues. Now, of course, conventional medicine recognizes those factors, but it's not set up in a way to actually facilitate those kind of changes. If you have only 10 minutes with your GP, that's just enough time to collect your symptoms, prescribe a medication, and shuffle you out the door.
Right.
So that's the primary difference. Another one is focusing on prevention instead of waiting until the patient is already so far down the track that it's, you know, whatever their problem is nearly irreversible, and the best you can do is manage it with drugs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of people speak about the fact that, you know, institutions like our NHS are built on really dealing with acute conditions, which of course were the most prevalent thing some time back, when chronic disease wasn't like it is now. But of course people got infections and had accidents and all these things, and of course they are very good at acute management. In this country, I think where I'd rank the NHS as right up there as one of the best. And but of course this is a similar kind of approach. Somebody comes along, right, well, we've got to just fix them quickly and get them out the door.
Yeah, that's a great point. So in the year 1900, these are US statistics, but I imagine they're similar in the UK. The top three causes of death were acute infectious disease. So we had typhoid, pneumonia, and tuberculosis.
Right.
Treatment was relatively straightforward. It didn't always work,
no.
But it was one patient, one problem, one doctor, right. You know. And most of the reason, as you pointed out, that people saw doctors were acute problems. If it wasn't an infection, it might have been a gallbladder attack or an appendicitis. So the doctor would maybe do surgery and remove the gallbladder, or they, once antibiotics were invented, they would prescribe an antibiotic, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
Today is a totally different landscape. 7 out of the top 10 causes of death are chronic diseases,
mm-hmm.
and these don't lend themselves to that single doctor, single treatment methodology. Instead, we have the average patient has multiple chronic diseases, is taking multiple medications, is seeing multiple doctors, including a different doctor for every different part of the body in
yes.
many cases, and they're not talking to one another.
Uh-huh.
And then those treatments will last a lifetime. As I said before, if you go to the doctor and you get prescribed a medication for high blood pressure, you're supposed to take that for the rest of your life.
Right.
So it's a totally different landscape, and our model just didn't evolve to address chronic disease.
Mm-hmm. So in steps functional medicine. So it seems to be winning hearts and minds, functional medicine, in both the nutritional world and the orthodox world, and it's succeeding where many other initiatives in this direction have had little impact. So what do you think it is about functional medicine that's making it sort of take hold?
I think we're just ripe for it. It's clear that what we've been doing so far hasn't worked.
Right.
For example, in the US, 1 in 2 Americans now have a chronic disease, 1 in 4 have multiple chronic diseases. 86% of the nearly $4 trillion that we spend in the States on healthcare goes toward chronic disease.
86%.
And, you know, if spending continues at its current pace, the U.S. is going to be completely insolvent financially or bankrupt by the year 2035. So the writing's on the wall. You know, our current path is not only not solving the chronic disease epidemic, it's going to completely bankrupt our country, and healthcare is widely recognized as not being sustainable.
Mm.
So functional medicine actually offers a solution to this problem where we can not only prevent but even reverse many chronic diseases, and not only that, we can do it in many cases without unnecessary drugs or surgery, and we can empower patients to take charge of their own health. And I think that's a win-win message for doctors, for patients, and for society as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not very far ahead, that crash date.
Within our lifetime.
Yeah. So you've already described it's a particular way of looking at healthcare functional medicine, and it's foundationally different to orthodox medicine in that way. So does this make functional medicine an alternative to orthodox medicine, or is there actually a genuine case for kind of integration of the two?
I would argue that functional medicine will eventually be medicine. We won't call it functional medicine. At some point, we'll just call it medicine, and it will incorporate the best of what we now call traditional allopathic or conventional medicine. So, for example, there will always be a need for some of the advanced diagnostic procedures that
mm-hmm.
conventional medicine has brought us. And it's brought us some amazing things, as you pointed out. I mean, we're starting to be able to restore sight to the blind, to reattach limbs, possibly to fight cancer with nanorobots at some point in our lifetimes. It's conceivable. If I get hit by a bus, I definitely want to be taken to the hospital.
Yeah.
But I think we can all agree that it hasn't been great at preventing or reversing chronic disease, which is where functional medicine excels. So I think if we combine the functional medicine approach to preventing and reversing chronic disease and then utilize conventional medicine where it shines, which is with acute trauma and emergency care and some of the more advanced diagnostic procedures, then we can live longer lifespans than we ever have and enjoy a higher quality of life than we ever have before.
Mm, interesting. So it's a kind of horses for courses situation.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them have their strengths and
yes.
Yeah, sit alongside each other. Mm. Okay, so heading a little bit more in the cancer direction now. In mainstream medicine, cancer's all about genetics. You know, genes are the problem. But outside of the mainstream, it's all about epigenetics, the environment surrounding our genes. That's seen as the problem. So that's a very significantly different perspective. However, it does seem that there's actually some useful crossover going on, as much as the information that's now readily available from genetic profiling is proving useful in providing a picture of an individual at a genetic level, and is therefore can tell us about what a good environment actually looks like for that person. Can you like to tell us how this is coming into play within functional medicine and the functional medicine view?
Sure. Yeah, it's a good example of what we just talked about, the combination of what conventional medicine and analytics and testing can provide versus the functional perspective. So the functional perspective on cancer is that, like all other chronic diseases, it's primarily driven by environmental factors. Genes do play a role in predisposing risk to cancer and other chronic disease, but studies have overwhelmingly found that 85% of chronic disease risk, including cancer, is environmental and not genetic. However, how we respond to these environmental insults, like poor diet, poor sleep, lack of physical activity, too much exposure to artificial light, toxins, etc., is determined by our genes. So for example, one person might get diabetes, another person might get cancer, and that's, you know, when they're exposed to this modern environment, and that's driven by genetic factors. So the ways that we can use genes and understanding genes effectively include knowing which diet and behavior and lifestyle choices are appropriate for a given person. So for example, one person with certain genes might do better on a relatively lower carbohydrate and higher fat diet, whereas another person might do better, you know, with a moderate fat and moderate carbohydrate diet. From the conventional perspective, some of the newer drugs that are being developed for cancer are based on genetics and receptors for a particular gene expression, where drugs can be very precisely targeted to cancer cells and without harming normal healthy cells, which is of course one of the key focuses of cancer treatment.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, so that's useful specific information about individuals. Now, I mean, this term personalized medicine, it kind of comes from the alternative world, really, doesn't it?
Yes.
But it's actually suddenly been applied to orthodox medicine once genetics has come into the picture, and they're now very much talking about personalizing treatment to the patient. It's kind of, if you like, what's evolved from a failed investigation to find out this genetic postcode of prostate cancer, which was never going to happen, obviously, but they've had to do something with the information, and they have actually found some uses for it here. Everybody is finding some uses for this cheap genetic information, which was so inaccessible before, and it could turn out to be a very positive step. No,
I think so. I think we've seen an interesting progression with genetic information. You know, back when the human genome was first sequenced, there was a lot of hoopla, like, this is the end of chronic disease, and
right.
You know, we've now solved the human health puzzle, and I think we all know how that turned out. It didn't really work out as promised. And then I think that we went a little far in the other direction, where it was, you know, we initially had access to this genetic data, we couldn't really make sense of it.
Mm.
We knew that it might be important at some point, but we didn't know how to actually make sense of it because it was so overwhelming. And then we learned about that the expression of genes, which you referred to before, the study of epigenetics, is far more important than the underlying genes themselves. And that expression of genes is controlled by environmental factors. So now I feel like we're getting back to a healthier understanding of how genes can wisely be used to make personal choices about healthcare and treatment. But still recognizing that at the end of the day, in terms of the modifiable risk factors, considering things like diet, physical activity, stress and sleep are still probably the, you know, where we're going to get the biggest bang for our buck in terms of preventing and reversing disease.
Mm. But it's interesting when we can start to tailor approaches to restoring health based on somebody's genetic profile, though, isn't it? That's
absolutely
useful.
Yeah, and that's where I see in the next 10 years that we're gonna have the most innovation and development there. There are already some new tests that are coming on the market, like advanced transcriptomic testing, microbiome testing, that can help us as clinicians to make choice, you know, to advise our patients about specific choices that they could make based not only on their genes, but also on their gene expression, which we're beginning to be able to measure now as well.
Right. That's very interesting. You talked about testing the state of someone's microbiome. I mean, this is something that's, you know, almost everybody I talk to on this show these days, that word comes in somewhere,
yeah.
Because it's being seen as so foundational to people's well-being in every single way imaginable. And but, of course, it's sort of largely been a sort of an unknown, if you like, in as much as, well, okay, you could have one that wasn't very active, that was sort of largely dead because of the treatment they'd had, or
yeah.
It could be active, but
yeah.
This is much more specific what you're talking about.
Yeah,
it?
So originally, you know, the method of assessing the microbiome was 16S DNA sequencing, and that there are a lot of disadvantages to that method, and you mentioned one of them, where you can't tell whether an organism is viable that you
right.
detect in the stool. Is, you know, is it alive and causing problems, or is it dead? Also, you can't get down to the species level in many cases with 16S sequencing. But there's a new generation of microbiome testing coming out that's offered by companies like Viome, which is run by Naveen Jain, who has more of a history in data analytics than in health. But
okay.
He's applying...
That's the way it's going.
That's right. He's applying that. And that gets into the omics, like proteomics and transcriptomics and metabolomics, which is able to look at the not only the genes but the expression of genes, and also to look at things at a much finer level all the way down to the species level, and then also to look at whether the organism is actually viable and alive versus being dead. Then they're seeking to apply big data analytics technology to start to discern patterns. So one of the problems with the microbiome testing so far is that we don't still really know what a normal microbiome looks like.
Right.
And how that differs from person to person based on geography, culture, ethnicity, diet, etc. And so the application of big data will help us to start learning more about what these normal patterns are and what the deviant patterns are, and therefore be able to clinically apply this data in a meaningful way.
Mm, that's very interesting. I mean, going back to where our zookeepers, of course, this is where the effect really starts. You start feeding weird food to animals, then that's the first thing that's going to go up the chute, isn't it, is their microbiome, really.
Yeah, and there was an influential paper written by Dr. Ian Spreadsbury out of New Zealand,
mm-hmm.
where he demonstrated that one of the primary negative effects of the Western diet is processed and refined carbohydrate. That was not a newsflash, but what he showed is that these processed and refined foods have a very harmful effect on the gut microbiota. They feed, you know, pathogenic species of bacteria that then multiply and become overrepresented, and they don't feed the highly beneficial species like bifidobacteria and lactobacillus that we need to thrive.
Well, that's very interesting, isn't it? And not exactly unexpected in a way.
No,
it's kind of what,
not at all.
It just confirms what we already knew clinically.
Yes.
In a way. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Western prices research into traditional diets in native populations around the world has long been a kind of touchstone for me when it comes to the latest sort of one-size-fits-all dietary advice. I just think, well, probably not.
Yeah.
You know, it's brilliant what he did, I think, then. He sort of captured a moment in time just before all those native diets disappeared, really. They were already going at the time he was doing the research. They were beginning to disappear. But, you know, it clearly demonstrates to me just how much the human body can and does adapt to the environment into which it's placed and the available sources of food. So, you know, he had, you know, people that ate dairy,
yeah.
people who'd never seen a vegetable in their life, you know, all these kind of things which are sort of cut right through the ideas we have of what's good for human beings. It's moved my attention, if you like, more away from what the food is to what's been done to it, and also what is the person, how are they adapted what's their particular adaptation and what works for them. So, you know, the old saying that one man's meat's another man's poison seems to cover it quite well, in fact. So you've already mentioned that you obviously see people as having different dietary needs, and this is where this kind of genetic view can help. Do you want to say a bit more about this whole field about, you know, the different types and their dietary requirements?
Mm-hmm. So I think I agree with you that Weston Price's research was groundbreaking, and there have been many other researchers that, like Dr. Stefan Lindeberg and Guervin and Kaplan, anthropologists who studied traditional diets. And I would agree that their research clearly shows that humans can thrive on a wide variety of macronutrient ratios, you know, differing ratios of protein and fat and carbohydrate, different types of foods, and that those will vary, again, geographically, ethnically, and, you know, depending on what's available. On the other hand, their research also clearly showed that these traditional diets had several things in common.
Right.
So they didn't consist of, you know, Doritos and Big Gulps and Twinkies ever.
Right.
Nobody was eating processed and refined foods.
Right.
And, you know, no one was eating highly toxic foods. Nobody was eating, you know, a lot of additives and preservatives and things like that. So, and what he was also able to show in his research quite brilliantly was that when people from a traditional native group started to adopt a refined diet, they immediately got sick. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, he was a dentist, so he was mostly looking at people's teeth, and it showed up within a single generation.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, he actually has pictures in his book.
Yes.
Of people from the exact same tribe, you know, who's stuck with their traditional diet, and they have beautiful facial structure and teeth and wide dental arch, and then the within one generation that completely deteriorates on a modern processed diet.
Mm.
So, you know, I think his research, along with many other researchers' work, puts to rest the idea that everyone should be on a low-carb diet or everyone should be on a low-fat diet. Or some of these, you know, claims that are made.
Mediterranean diet,
whatever
big.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah.
The reality is that we all can thrive on a whole foods diet based on our, you know, genes, our health status, our particular needs. For example, if someone is an athlete that's training for a major competition, their needs are going to be perhaps profoundly different than a sedentary office worker who's 60 pounds overweight.
Right.
And I feel like that's been lost in a lot of the conversation about diet, but we are starting to, thankfully, move more in that direction.
Yeah, it's very interesting that Weston Price came in with this dentist's view, in a way, isn't it? Other people wouldn't have noticed what he noticed, I think.
Right.
But all those photographs are very telling, and we all know that, you know, when you've seen pictures of people in the Amazon, that they do tend to have these very perfect rounded faces.
Mm.
And he showed how compressed they became, underdeveloped and everything, with poor nutrition. Very interesting.
Yes, and there's a lot of work correlating the structure of the jaw and the dental arch with health in the conventional peer-reviewed research literature.
Right.
Yeah.
And the problem, in a way, that we have, which hopefully genetics might help us with, is kind of unwrapping the puzzle of, like, who we are, because of course everybody's so muddled up now.
Yeah.
You know, that's sort of clear.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, I come from the North Pole and I eat whales.
Right.
It doesn't exist anymore, really.
Yeah.
And so who are we and what should we be eating? It's quite a puzzle, isn't it?
It is, and I think there are a few ways to answer that. One is this newer testing that's becoming available that we've been talking about so far, genetics, but really, more appropriately, genomics, which is the study of how all of the genes interact, not just single genes themselves. And then the newer omics, like transcriptomics, proteomics, metabolomics, which look at gene expression in real time. But also, good old-fashioned experimentation still plays a role. You know, when I start working with a new patient, I'll typically have them do a 30-day elimination diet where they remove most of the foods that we know cause problems for the greatest number of people, like gluten and dairy and processed and refined food. But after that, then we start doing some fiddling. Do you feel better with more fat relative to carbohydrate or more carbohydrate relative to fat? Do you feel better with a little bit higher protein intake? Or in some cases, people do better with a little bit lower protein intake. So you still can learn a tremendous amount by doing some controlled experimentation.
Mm-hmm. Which, of course, is in the realms of possibility for a lot of people.
Absolutely. Yeah. And yeah. One other thing I'd point out about that is our optimal diet might change over our lifetime. Mm. So, for example, if I am a young person who's exercising a tremendous amount, you know, training a lot and very active, my diet might require more protein and perhaps more carbohydrate. Maybe 15 years later, I've dropped my training, I have an office job, and I'm exercising less, and I've put on 25 pounds, and I'm starting to become insulin and leptin resistant and have blood sugar problems. At that point, a lower carbohydrate, higher protein, you know, higher fat diet might become appropriate. So, mm-hmm. You know, even within the individual, making sure we keep this perspective that there's not even a one-size-fits-all approach for me throughout my lifetime is important.
And I mean, that the thing you just described is kind of dependent on my activity in the world, if mm-hmm. you like, or my interactions with the world. Is there also a factor which is simply age-dependent, which is to do with how the metabolism changes over our lifetime?
I think so, in many cases, yeah. I mean, I have many patients and also professional colleagues that have found that their dietary needs have changed over time. And, you know, I think that's probably not surprising and quite appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the media is permanently awash with new dietary programs, many of them overlapping variations on a theme. It's a thoroughly confusing area, and the biggest single change in advice in recent years has been the one you've already alluded to, which is the move away from reliance on carbs towards the previously demonized fats for our fuel. So I think it's fair to say that your hugely successful book, The Paleo Cure, sits in this space. Would you give us an overview of the paleo and of the principles behind it?
Sure. So the paleo approach is based on the idea that we discussed earlier, which is that human beings, for the vast majority of our evolutionary history, 66,000 generations, a little over 2 million years of hominid evolution, long time, ate basically some combination of meat and fish, wild fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, and some starchy plants. It may seem like our modern diet is normal because it's all we've known and maybe even our parents have known. But the reality is, if we look at human history on the scale of a football field, and I'm talking about American football here,
okay.
So it's 100 yards long.
Okay.
If we start walking at one end of the end zone to the other, you could walk for 99 and a half yards, and that would represent the period of time humans lived as hunter-gatherers and ate this diet that
right.
I just mentioned. It's only in the last half yard of that 100-yard football field that we developed agriculture, and it's only in the last few inches of that last half yard that the Industrial Revolution occurred. But even within that, just 50 years ago or 100 years ago in the UK and in the US, our diet was profoundly different.
Yes.
Our grandparents even, and certainly our great-grandparents, were not eating Twinkies and cheese doodles and drinking big gulps. They might have been having bread and grains, sure,
mm-hmm.
but they were predominantly eating real foods. They were often still eating the organ meats and offal, which are very nutrient dense.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't restricting fats. The fats that they ate were natural traditional fats like butter and, you know, animal fat, not the industrial seed oils like soybean and cottonseed oil and canola oil that are in many processed and refined foods now. So I would say that there has been a profound and dramatic shift away from our natural human diet, even in the last 50 to 100 years, but certainly over that longer evolutionary timescale.
Mm-hmm. So the paleo diet then looks to restore, as far as possible, simple, straightforward natural foods that have not been processed in any way,
yeah,
and fall within those categories you described.
And if we could use three terms to describe it, it would be nutrient dense,
mm-hmm.
Relatively low in calories per weight of food. I'll explain that in a moment.
Okay, yeah.
And anti-inflammatory. Whereas the modern diet is just the reverse in all
right.
three of those categories. It's nutrient poor,
yeah,
calorie dense, and pro-inflammatory.
Okay, well, yeah, say a bit more about those last
yeah.
two.
So nutrient density is crucial because all our body runs on nutrients. Micronutrients are literally the fuel for our body. There are several essential vitamins and minerals that we need to function well. And if we get suboptimal levels of any of these, we're going to develop chronic disease. That's not controversial. It's well established. So you look at a food like bread, which has become a staple of both the American and the UK diet. It's relatively high in calories, but it's relatively low in nutrients. Whereas you look at meats, fresh fruits and fresh vegetables, nuts and seeds, and even certain starchy tubers like sweet potatoes, they're relatively high in nutrients that we need to function well, but they're actually relatively low in calories because they have a lot of water and they have a lot of fiber. And those are things that make us feel satiated and full. So we'll naturally eat fewer calories when we eat those foods and we'll get more nutrients. And then I mentioned anti-inflammatory versus pro-inflammatory. Well, we now know that virtually all chronic disease is inflammatory in origin, including cancer, of course. And so the name of the game to avoid chronic disease is to reduce inflammation. Well, most of the foods that we're eating that are comprising the majority of our diet now are inflammatory. Those highly processed and refined foods cause changes in the gut microbiota that cause inflammation, which is what Dr. Spreadsbury noticed. Sugar is known inflammatory trigger. Gluten can be an inflammatory trigger for many people, and same with all of the processed and refined foods.
Right.
Okay. So that's quite a clear and simple guideline in a way, isn't it? You can steer your food choice in that direction.
I sometimes tell people, look, if they feel overwhelmed by all this complexity, I say, here are three words to guide your choices.
Right.
Eat real food.
Excellent. No, I'm right with that. Okay. All right, so I'd like to ask a cancer-specific question now. In the UK, most people, apart from oncologists that is, are aware of the fact that A, there's a big problem around sugar, and B, it's bad news if you have cancer. What there seems to be more disagreement about concerns the different types of sugar. So some practitioners, for example, they lump fruit sugar right in there with the granulated. They don't differentiate between the two, so it doesn't matter which kind it is, it's all going to be bad news if you've got cancer. So what's your take on this? Is there, you know, is it just as bad to have carrots as it is to put three sugars in your tea?
I don't think so.
Right, no. Why not?
No. So, again, if we think about how human beings are adapted in our natural environment, you know, these fruits and vegetables have been a part of our diet since, you know, before we were human, actually. Before we came down out of the trees onto the savannah, we were eating fruits. In fact, we were only eating fruits and perhaps some vegetables and plant foods at that time. Fruits have a lot of fiber in them and a lot of water, and we don't respond in the same way to those sugars in those foods because that fiber makes it harder for us to absorb the sugars and spreads out the absorption of those sugars over time. Some recent studies have come out that have suggested that even type 2 diabetics who have severe problems processing sugars don't see an increase in their blood sugars or symptoms when eating moderate amount of whole fruits. Whereas we know that eating highly processed and refined foods can trigger big blood sugar and insulin spikes in that population. As for cancer, I think if we're talking about prevention and even treatment, let's separate those out for a second.
Okay.
For prevention, I don't see any need at all to avoid sugars in whole foods like fruit and especially vegetables like carrots. For treatment, I think the jury is still out to some degree. There are certainly some clinicians and researchers that are actively exploring a very low carbohydrate diet or ketogenic diet for the treatment of cancer, and they're seeing some interesting results there. And so I think from that perspective, you could make an argument for even restricting natural sugars. But in my opinion, although that is very compelling research and very interesting, and I think we need to pursue it further, I'm not yet convinced that every person with cancer should be on a ketogenic diet.
Okay. What you're saying is there may be a case for this, but it's much more person and cancer specific, and this is like a treatment basically, and it's not like life.
Yeah.
This is what we're doing to actually deal with a particular situation at a particular time.
It's a therapeutic protocol. And an analogy I like to use for people is if you break your arm, you put a cast on it, but you don't keep wearing the cast after your arm is broken, and you don't put casts on your arms to prevent you from breaking your arm in the first place.
Intuitively, being warned off fruit doesn't do it for me. You know what I mean? It's like, as you say, these things are there in nature, we're nature, they've been there always. And so I find it very hard to see them as in any way harmful to us.
And I've never
messed with.
Incidentally, I've never seen a study. Mm. I've always asked or challenged people who say that, you know, fruit's bad for you and we shouldn't eat it and it's going to cause diabetes. I've never seen one study that supports that. And I've seen many studies, which I've written about on my blog, that show that not only does whole fruit consumption not contribute to the risk of diabetes, it actually is associated with a lower risk of diabetes.
Right.
Furthermore, as I just mentioned, there are studies showing that fruit consumption, even when somebody already has diabetes, isn't problematic. So I don't know where those claims, I guess I know where they come from. It's this kind of blanket idea that sugar is bad and since it's bad in refined form, it must be bad in any form. But I don't think there's any evidence to support that.
No. All right. Nice to have some logic behind it, because my feeling about it is more intuitive, but it's
backed up by the research.
And it's interesting to talk about the ketogenic diet also in terms of a diet. It seems to be emerging, as you've said, to have a role as a treatment for people with cancer, you know, for a period. It seems to be extremely useful, either on its own or in combination with other treatments, particularly is where it's emerging in strength, is it kind of supports
chemotherapy, for example,
basic ordinary treatment seems to make them much better. And it's interesting from that point of view, because it's rather like you know, a hypothermia is seen in the same way. It's not there's no great shakes as a way of treating cancer, but if you do it with anything else, it makes it more effective. So it's a kind of underlying all-purpose thing that people with cancer can do, whatever the treatment they're doing is, which is very useful.
Right. My understanding of it so far from the research is that ketogenic diets seem to protect human cells from the effects of these treatments like chemotherapy, for example. And the same is true for fasting, which of course produces ketosis, so that may be one reason that fasting helps, but fasting appears to have some other benefits, such as the upregulation of a process called autophagy, which is a cellular repair process, which of course makes sense if if someone's undergoing cancer treatment, there's going to be a lot of cellular damage, so fasting could mitigate some of the effects of that. Ketogenic diets also have applications for neurodegenerative conditions like Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease, so I think it's a very important tool in our approach to these conditions. But where I stop short is with the assumption that because it's a therapeutic tool, that we should therefore all be on a ketogenic diet for the rest of our lives.
Your Faust analogy.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, and incidentally, you know, there's never been a contemporary hunter-gatherer population or previous previous population that people like Weston and Price studied that willingly followed a ketogenic diet.
Right.
The Inuit probably got closest, but that was purely because they live in a very marginal environment where they didn't have access to fruits and vegetables for some parts of the year. So naturally they would enter periods of ketosis. But as soon as they did have access to plant foods, they would eat them, like in the spring, in the summer, and they would trade for them as well. And I think it's also a reasonable argument that traditional hunter-gatherer populations would go into periods of ketosis during times of food scarcity.
Yeah.
So when they didn't have access to as much food, or when they had access to only marginal foods, then they would enter ketosis for a few days, for example, or maybe a week. So if someone is, this is more advanced strategy, I don't know that it's necessary for the average person, but if someone really wants to optimize their longevity and health span, then I think you could make an argument for occasional periods of a ketogenic diet or occasional periods of fasting to help kind of regulate and tune the body and the immune system.
Well, this is one of the big changes, of course, for the majority of the population, probably, is going from a position where
food was on and off
yes.
to being permanent and probably too much and mainly carbs, you know.
Yeah, yes.
So, you know, it is a very different scenario. And of course, the whole ketogenic process is completely dormant, really, for most people for their whole lives, probably.
And that's because we are hardwired for an environment of food scarcity and not food abundance.
Mm.
So let me say a little bit more about that. Evolution is ruthless in many ways, and the qualities that we have now were selected for over many, many generations as qualities that helped us survive in our natural environment. So human beings were originally programmed to seek out highly calorie dense and rewarding foods because those are the humans that would have survived periods of food scarcity.
Mm.
You know, people who are gobbling up as many calories as they can, kind of insulating themselves for those periods of food shortage so that they could survive that scarcity. That programming was very helpful at that time. But what happens when we carry that same programming into an environment where there's a 7-Eleven or a supermarket on every corner that's selling calorie-dense, nutrient-poor foods? Well, we'll seek those out just like we did in our natural environment.
Mm-hmm.
But the difference is, as you pointed out, we have 24/7 access to them. So that hardwired programming backfires on us. And I feel that it's really important for people to understand that because they then become aware that they're subject to biologically hardwired mechanisms that they have very little conscious control over.
Mm.
And it then, I think, takes some of the personal burden away, the idea that there's something wrong with me and it's a failure of my will and I'm a glutton and, you know, that's why I can't lose weight or resist these cravings. It's completely natural to seek those out. And furthermore, it's not only natural, it's a strategy that would have helped our ancestors to survive.
Mm.
So once we understand that, we can actually make choices about our environment. You know, for example, not having those foods in the home because we recognize that we won't be able to resist them at times where our willpower is low.
Yeah.
And, you know, and choosing to eat foods that satisfy us and make us feel full, but have all of the nutrients that we need. So I think that's an important understanding for people to have.
Mm. And the other side of the coin, if you like, of all that built-in drive that we have is, of course, food scientists and corporations who actually have investigated these things to the ultimate level to find the things that are going to lure us the most. And, you know, I heard somebody talking about the development of this thing whereby you take the crisp out, put it in your mouth, and you get this explosion of taste, and then nothing. It disappears very quickly,
says
you're ready for the next one, and you're not satisfied by it.
Yes.
Brilliant. I mean, you know, this is a sort of ultimate in food engineering for them.
You're right. There are books written about this. The name is escaping me at the moment, but these big food companies hire the top scientists that understand these principles. There is a concept, I use the term rewarding earlier.
Right.
I'm using that in a specific psychological context. Something that is rewarding from a psychology perspective is something that makes us want to do more of that.
Right.
So foods that are highly rewarding are foods that make us want to eat more and more regardless of whether we're hungry. And the best example of this is imagine two plates. On the left you have a baked potato with no butter or salt, just a plain baked potato. And on the right you have potato chips,
all right,
or you know, French fries or chips as you call them here,
yeah.
with salt and lots of fat and oil. And imagine that you're relatively full, you've just had a meal. Well, you're probably not going to want any of the plain baked potato, but you just might eat some of the chips
and then end up eating more than you expected.
Exactly. And this is the problem, and because we live in this environment where foods are engineered to be rewarding so that companies will sell more of them.
Mm-hmm.
And we, because of that hardwired programming that I mentioned, we're not capable in many cases of withstanding that. In the States, I'm not sure if this was, the advertising campaign was here as well. There's a company called Pringles, or a potato chip called Pringles.
And
they actually had an advertisement that said, "I bet you can't just eat one."
Right. Okay. Well, that's what they're engineered for.
They knew you would lose that bet.
Yeah.
That was not a good bet to take because most people cannot just eat one.
Right.
Yeah, well, it's another reason to steer towards the kind of foods that you were talking about, which is
that's
the
right.
ones that have been least tampered with, really, because the motives behind the tampering are not usually ones of health.
And I want to be clear, this doesn't mean we can't enjoy food.
Right.
So think of the steak. Many people enjoy eating steak,
mm.
but they're probably not going to eat it when they're not hungry.
Right.
You know, in the way that they would potato chips or crisps. They'll eat enough to feel satiated and they'll enjoy it while they're eating it.
Right.
But it's not the type of food that they're going to binge on, like ice cream.
Right. It's true. It's very different, isn't it?
Yeah. Still satisfying, still enjoyable, but not going to provoke that hardwired response that we have.
Mm. So it's good to recognize it in yourself,
absolutely.
That exact movement. Yeah. Okay, so the Yes Life Show, it's all about cancer and integrative medicine. So I'd like to go a step further in looking at the ways that functional medicine could help, particularly those people with cancer.
Mm-hmm.
One of the questions that orthodox medicine largely avoids when it comes to a cancer diagnosis is why. They're not really interested in why you got cancer. If you ask them, they usually shrug their shoulders and, you know, bad luck or something.
Yeah.
So there would seem to be a massive gap in the market here for some useful work by functional medicine, which would naturally lead to quite a bit of information about what to do in order to regain full health. So how important do you think that functional medicine could be to somebody who's got cancer?
I think it's crucial both for cancer prevention and someone who has cancer. So if I could just use an analogy here, Alzheimer's is another condition that has historically been attributed solely to genes, and it's a similar idea. If you get Alzheimer's, bad luck for you, sorry about that, and by the way, there's not really much that we can do. In fact, there are fewer treatments for Alzheimer's than there are for cancer.
On Alzheimer's yet.
Yeah, 25 years of drug development, there's not a single drug that can reverse or even slow the process of Alzheimer's, because that paradigm we've applied to it of single disease, single drug, you know, single treatment just doesn't work. But there are people like Dr. Dale Bredesen who are now have argued that Alzheimer's can, we do understand many things that contribute to Alzheimer's, and it can be prevented and in some cases even reversed by taking a functional medicine approach. So I would argue the same with cancer. Certainly genes are important in terms of the predisposition to cancer. We know that, and I'm not arguing with that. But if we remember that 85% of risk chronic disease is environmental, then what functional medicine can do is it can help us to look at things like gut health, blood sugar regulation, nutrient status, HPA axis function, which really refers to the effect that stress has on our physiology. We can look at environmental toxins, which have been shown to play a significant role in cancer pathogenesis, and many of these kind of fundamental mechanisms that really their primary net effects is to cause inflammation, and inflammation is a major driving factor for the cancer process. So if a patient already has cancer, addressing and resolving all of these underlying triggers for inflammation and cellular dysregulation can be an important part of the overall approach. I'm not arguing that it will necessarily cure cancer, but when used together with other treatments that are more specific for cancer, I think it can absolutely improve the patient's prognosis.
So within the description you've just given, there's clearly a big role for really the big killer, if you like, which is recurrence. That's what happens in this country.
Yes.
You know, people given the all clear, we got it early, it's all fine, off you go. And then, you know, people walk out with their fingers crossed hoping for the best. There's no strategy for staying well. And then 9 months later, sorry, you've got secondaries. And, you know, they're in a terminal situation all of a sudden then. Now, that's because they've done nothing to resolve any of the issues that gave them cancer. And you've just described how you could be addressing often through functional medicine.
So that's a perfect example of the difference between the conventional and functional approach. The conventional approach is based on suppression or management of a disease. And so, for example, in cancer, even if chemotherapy or surgery is successful, if you haven't addressed the underlying processes that led to the cancer in the first place, it's simply going to recur, either sooner or later, depending on the patient's genes and how long it took to occur in the first place. Whereas from a functional medicine approach, we don't rule out the necessity of surgery or chemotherapy to deal with a cancer if it's that far, you know, if that's possible.
That's kind of an acute situation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's why I think a smart use of our conventional medical abilities. But we recognize that we'll get better results with the treatment, first of all, by addressing the underlying problems.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, we'll have much greater chance of avoiding recurrence if we address those underlying processes.
Mm. But also, one of the sort of legendary things about conventional treatments is they're pro-inflammatory, you know, and
yes,
they destroy your gut microbiome, things like that. So presumably there's a role there for also kind of partnering up with the orthodox medicine to make it less destructive.
Yes, and we discussed the ketogenic diet and fasting in
yeah.
that context earlier, where they may protect healthy cells. There are also nutrients like vitamin C, which help protect against oxidative
mm-hmm.
damage, and others that can be used, a whole range of functional medicine approaches that can be used to mitigate the potentially harmful effects of those conventional treatments.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so an important role.
I think so, and I think it's, as I mentioned, at some point we won't even be talking about this as functional medicine or some separate thing. It's just going to be the future of medicine. Now, when that future will arrive is the big question. You mentioned in the US that there's already a lot of enthusiasm about this. For example, Cleveland Clinic, which is one of the most prestigious medical organizations in the world, now has a huge center for functional medicine. They started in this tiny space. They've now grown into a 17,000 square foot facility that's in Glickman Tower, which is one, you know, the top building in the center. They have a wait list of 2,600 patients.
Yeah.
So it's really driving demand there. But I will say, in the UK,
yeah.
I was here 2 years ago,
yeah,
and I think there were 90 healthcare practitioners. I did an event specifically for healthcare practitioners. There were, I think, 90 or 95 people, and this last time there were 175. So in 2 years, almost a doubling.
Doubled, yeah.
And a lot of GPs in the audience who are working within the NHS. So I think it's happening here. It's just a little bit slower.
Quite a bit slower. That's described as the Rongan effect,
yes.
which is actually because Dr. Chassie's been on the TV,
yes.
taking people off drugs, changing their lives, and making them better.
Yeah.
And that has had the most awesome effect, has inspired a lot of GPs, quite apart from the public, you know. He's been an enormous inspiration to so many people. So that's why I think he, of course, he's at the head of a whole weight that's been pushing
yes.
in this direction for decades, but
yes.
he's the man nonetheless who seems to have broken through and created a crack in the
absolutely.
System.
Absolutely. And he's also been the subject of some pushback, which,
well, of course.
If you understand the stages of change, what Schopenhauer
yeah.
said, first
yeah.
it's a new perspective. First it's denied, second it's ridiculed, and third it's accepted as self-evident. So
yeah.
I actually see it as a good thing
yes.
when that pushback is happening, because that means functional medicine is getting big enough to get on the radar
right.
of you know, the conventional
yeah.
medical establishment, and they're feeling threatened by that, which I don't think they should. I think there's a way that we, like I said before,
okay.
that we can work together.
All the strengths together, yes.
But that doesn't mean the process won't be a little bit messy
yeah.
to get there.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll have to break some eggs.
Well, thank you. Well put. Looking at the overall picture of healthcare in the UK, one of the biggest obstacles to the advancement of functional medicine in public health is the practicality of moving
mm-hmm.
a system that at the moment invests so little time in people,
yes.
and functional medicine, you know, it just simply can't work under those conditions, can it? There is more investment in people. So how can this hurdle be overcome? You've got some experience from America where it's actually
yeah.
happening.
Yeah.
You know, if we need to know in Britain here, well, how can we suddenly go from the 5-minute GP appointment to actually treating people in this way?
That's a great question. It was a big subject of discussion at my practitioner event.
Right.
And we're lucky to have Dr. Rangan Chatterjee there, as well as Dr. Tamsin Lewis, who's
right.
another GP here in the UK who's using a functional approach. And there are a few things I would say about that. Number one, in the US, we have the same situation where the average appointment length with a primary care provider within the insurance model is 10 minutes.
Right.
And I think it's about the same here
I think
with
it's
the NHS.
Yeah.
So, and we have the same problem where people who are limited to getting care within that insurance model are finding it difficult to access functional medicine because of all of the limitations of that model.
Mm.
and the unwillingness of inability, frankly, of providers who are working within that system to order the functional medicine testing and talk to patients about diet and lifestyle and behavior change. On the other hand, the reason I think it has advanced a little bit more quickly in the US is that we have a history of not having a single payer healthcare system, and people are much more accustomed to paying for their own healthcare, and willing to do that when the insurance-based model is not providing what they need. And so while I see the tremendous benefits of having a single payer system where your basic needs are covered here, I think that has become been somewhat of an impediment, because the reality is, at least as far as I can see it, with the chronic disease burden as it is and as it continues to grow, we're simply not going to be able to pay for all of the care that everybody needs as a society. It will bankrupt our government and your government if we do that. So where I see this, I see the only solution to this, and this may not be popular or it may not be what people want, but I think it's what's actually possible, is that we do have a system that will pay for that acute emergency trauma care for certain types of preventative testing, etc., but does not necessarily pay for the diet, behavior, lifestyle change, and, you know, a more comprehensive functional medicine approach. And I think, though, that where we can see some cost efficiency and changes is that if we use that functional medicine approach, we're going to need a lot less of that acute trauma and emergency care. And so I think it could actually become affordable for governments.
But also, I mean, even if you stay within the realms of the chronic disease, of course, if you give people the tools to manage it themselves without expensive drugs,
that's right.
Surely, you know, in the longer term, this is a short-term investment for long-term saving, in fact. Okay, look, we're going to have to end it there. As I said at the beginning, I thought there was a lot we could talk about.
Yes, it's for sure.
Enormously informative. And thank you for coming over to the UK, doing your bit, pushing the agenda forward in the UK that's so much needed towards a better form of healthcare.
My pleasure. And I just want to, again, recognize the work of Dr. Rangan Chatterjee and Tamsin Lewis and many other GPs and physicians working both within the NHS and privately to bring this forward. As I mentioned, there were 170 at the event, and I know that there's you're going to see a lot more of this in the coming years.
Great. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
As you've heard, America is showing us the way with functional medicine, and I'm really pleased that at last the UK is beginning to sit up and take note. Links to material mentioned in today's show are on the Yes to Life website as usual. Just go to yestolife.org.uk and click on the show logo on the homepage. Next week, I shall be talking to another American practitioner, Kurt Newman, MD, about a subject that I've never covered before, but one that's very close to my own heart. Childhood cancers. Goodbye.